This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about some recent United States Supreme Court cases that I think you'll find interesting, and we'll talk about perhaps what the future may hold of cases that are either before the Supreme Court or maybe coming before the Supreme Court. My guests are Myron Moskovitz, constitutional law professor at Golden Gate University School of Law; Ira Howard Barg, a specialist in criminal law. He's an assistant district attorney, San Francisco District Attorney's Office, and last year he was the chair of the Criminal Law Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. My third guest is Steve Mayer, a specialist in appellate law, and by specialist, that means they are certified by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which has 11 certified specialties. I'll briefly let you know what they are: appellate law, bankruptcy law, criminal law, estate planning, trust and probate law, family law, franchise and distribution law, immigration and nationality law, taxation law, workers' compensation law, legal malpractice law, and admiralty and maritime law. Additional funding is provided by the Family Law Section of the State Bar and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. And for those of you who listen to the program live, whether you're listening live in the Bay Area or on the internet at www.klw.org, I will give you a phone number that you can call in and talk with my guests in the second half hour of the program. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Really great to have you on the program. Let's do this. There's a case before, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, same-sex marriage case. I think is it Kitchen versus Herbert?
Kitchen versus Herbert, yeah.
Would you talk, Myron, would you talk a little bit about that, and what do you think may be happening here?
Well, this is a very strange situation. Last year, the Supreme Court decided two cases involving same-sex marriage. One involved the federal law that said the federal government would not recognize same-sex marriage in states that allowed it. It would not give federal benefits to spouses who are same-sex. And the Supreme Court held that unconstitutional. That violated the Fifth Amendment. And
that was the Defense of Marriage Act, was it?
That's
not?
Right, yeah. DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act.
Right.
The second case arose from the Prop 8 litigation in California, the Hollingsworth case, where it was a challenge to a state law, California's law, that banned same-sex marriage. Trial court held it was unconstitutional, went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Supreme Court held that the
California Supreme Court?
No. The U.S. Supreme Court held that the defendants did not have standing to appear in the appeal, and therefore the court did not have to reach the merits of whether same-sex marriage bans are constitutional. Well, since that happened, litigation has continued in some other states, and a few months ago, a federal district court in Utah held that Utah's ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. The state of Utah appealed that to the federal court of appeal, and the state asked for a stay of execution of the judgment so that they could maintain the status quo and not have same-sex marriages. And the trial court denied it. The court of appeal denied it. Then they went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which granted the stay. Now, maybe all that's happening is they feel that it would be just too messy if the court of appeal ends up invalidating upholding Utah's law, mm-hmm. and reversing the trial court to have these people married, and then you have to undo it. That's possible. So mm-hmm. maybe it had nothing to do with the merits. But it's also possible that the Supreme Court will get into the act and actually decide whether bans on same-sex marriages by the states is unconstitutional, something they ducked last time in the Prop 8 litigation.
Well, why do you think they wouldn't duck it this time?
Well, they don't have the same grounds to duck it.
The California
litigation was so messy because the state attorney general, then Jerry Brown, refused to defend the law. So you had these proponents come in, and it was questionable whether they had standing, mm-hmm. and the Supreme Court ultimately decided that they didn't.
Well, they could certainly duck it if the Tenth Circuit, which is the relevant Court of Appeals, upholds the law, then they could duck it. It'd be easier for them to duck it in that context than if the Tenth Circuit invalidates the law.
Yeah, perhaps.
That's only one of... There are cases all over the country being filed on this issue, and in one of them, surely, a court of appeals will invalidate a state law prohibiting same-sex marriage, and in that context, it would be very, very difficult for the court to duck the case.
And it only takes 4 votes on the U.S. Supreme Court to grant a hearing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take a majority.
And there are... I think there are those 4 votes, are there not?
That's, I don't know.
Oh, you don't? Oh.
Probably. I don't know. But sometimes... even if there's 4 votes, they won't do it if they don't think they have a majority.
That's right.
Why grant a hearing if you're going to lose?
Myron, can I ask a question to Zyra? the fact that some couples in Utah actually got married, and by invalidating the law, the U.S. Supreme Court would have to invalidate those marriages.
Yeah.
You think that might affect the decision?
Oh, no. I think it's too important to let a few people stand in the way of doing what the Supreme Court thinks is right.
Taking the right away from a person that had the right previously?
They didn't really have it.
I mean, they had it for a few weeks at most. And the California Supreme Court, when it held that San Francisco had acted illegally in 2005 in issuing same-sex marriage licenses, didn't have any trouble invalidating the marriages of people who had been married by San Francisco.
But wasn't there a case out of Colorado where the Supreme Court held that because a right had been given previously and the legislature or the electorate tried to take away the rights of certain groups, that that was improper? Do you think that might be the same type of holding here?
No. I mean, that was different. That was a Colorado initiative that permanently took away the rights of cities to pass laws protecting gays from private discrimination.
The right of cities,
yeah.
You said. Okay,
Yeah, because some cities in Colorado were passing laws that protected gays from private discrimination by landlords and merchants and employers, and the state tried to knock that out, and the Supreme Court said they couldn't do it.
Any prediction? Do you want to make any prediction of if it does come before the U.S. Supreme Court? If actually they do take it and actually work up an opinion, any recommendation or any indication what you think is going to happen?
I think they're going to look for a way to duck it again.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's not just that it's a hot issue, but it's a hot issue that it seems to be gradually taking care of itself. I mean,
right.
The political system is working. a lot of gay people may not think so, but compared to the civil rights movement, this is happening so fast. It's like lightning, mm-hmm. and it's spreading across the country, even in fairly conservative areas, that I think the court's going to feel, why should we get involved?
How do you feel it's correcting itself?
Yeah.
How do you feel it's correcting itself?
I think that the movement politically to permit gay marriage is gradually spreading across the country from my reading.
So various states are now supporting this. Okay.
Yeah.
All
right. Right. So there is the columnist, Nate Silver, put out an article several years ago in which he looked at the metrics of the various states and concluded that gay marriage would be legalized really everywhere by 2024 or 2030, just as a matter of demographics.
That's certainly
young people just don't care about it.
That's certainly a long time off, though.
That's right.
All right. It's our Call a Lawyer night, and I see Jeff Hayden. Jeff is standing up there. I don't know why he's standing up there, but he's waiting for your call. I in my promo, if you were listening somehow, I got confused, and I thought Jeff was going to be on the program with us tonight. It turns out that it was my mistake, and it's Ira Barg who's with us. But Jeff Hayden is here for Call a Lawyer night. It's 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. You can call and speak to any one of our, I think we have 9 attorneys here in various specialties and non-specialties, workers' compensation, criminal law, family law, Social Security law, immigration law, landlord-tenant law, employment law, tax law, real estate, patent law, aviation law, lemon law, BBB arbitration, and tomorrow, bankruptcy law, if you would like. I will give in the second half hour of the program an 800 number for our bankruptcy law certified specialist who's down in L.A. who you can call. Again, no obligation whatsoever. And in toward the end of this half hour, if you like, you can call in and talk with my guests on the air at 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, some indication of what may be coming before the U.S. Supreme Court, and we've just been talking about same-sex marriage and how the court may dodge it again or duck it again. My guests are two certified specialists, Steve Mayer, certified specialist in appellate law, Ira Howard Barg, certified specialist in criminal law, and constitutional law professor Myron Moskowitz.
Not just certified.
Certified, although...
I was going to say certifiable, but it's a little different.
He is certifiable, everybody. Ira just essentially retired from Golden Gate School of Law, University School of Law, after 40 years.
Oh, don't say that, Chuck.
Well, no. I think that's wonderful. I think it's truly wonderful. And you really still look good. You play tennis. You've got a little kid. This is terrific. Really, terrific.
It's fun.
All right. Let's go on now. We have gone from Kitchen versus Herbert, which is the same-sex marriage case. What about new technology? What's going on there, and why should we be concerned about that?
Well, the new technology of cell phones, the internet, GPS, all that stuff is giving these judges, especially older judges, fits in a lot of areas because a lot of them just don't get it, and their law clerks do.
Don't make it sound too bad.
Well,
please.
I'm in that camp, so there's nothing wrong with me.
Have a cell phone? Do you have a cell phone?
We just got indoor plumbing last week,
that's wonderful.
It's tough on me.
Good.
Anyway, the particular area where the Supreme Court has had some trouble recently is in criminal law. There's two cases pending now in the Supreme Court involving the following issue, on which the appellate courts around the country have split all over the place. You have this situation: a man is arrested, and under the law as it exists, the police have the right to search him incident to the arrest. As long as you have a valid arrest, the police can search his jacket pockets, a backpack if he's carrying it. And the rationale is he might have a weapon there and to hurt the police. And when people are arrested, they often get upset and resist. And the other thing you might have there is some evidence relating to the crime. So Supreme Court held several years ago that if you have a valid search incident, valid arrest, the police can search the whole person incident to the arrest, and that includes going through everything. So if they go through his pockets and they find a wallet, let's say, they can go through the wallet, and if he's got addresses in there, whatever, they can look at the whole thing, all right? And that's an automatic rule. And, now we live in a new world, and people have things like cell phones in their pockets. Now, if the police arrest somebody validly and they find a cell phone, can they open up the cell phone, turn it on, look at this guy's whole address book, look at all his messages, look at text messages? There could be hundreds, could be thousands, depending on the capacity of the phone. Some courts have said, yes, it's a cell phone's like a big wallet, or a big address book. It's the same thing, only it just happens to have more stuff. Other courts have said, wait a minute, this is quantitatively different, and that makes it qualitatively different. And you shouldn't the cops have the cell phone in their hands. They don't have to give it back to the guy.
So they have control of it.
They have control of it, so he can't reach it and turn, delete material. It's certainly not a weapon. So if the police have reason to think there's information on the phone that's relevant to the crime he committed, go to a magistrate, get a search warrant. If he approves it, search the cell phone.
And this comes up frequently in narcotics cases, does it
not?
Yeah,
it comes up in narcotics cases a lot because the police, whenever they arrest for narcotics, they're trying to find other people. They're trying to find the source, trying to find the customers. You know, it's a business, so you're going to have a whole chain of people. So they want to get it for that. I mean, there's cases where a cop picks up the cell phone after they arrest somebody, and the phone rings. You know, what do you do then? Sometimes they answer it and try to get the
guy. Mr. Smith is here.
That's right, yeah. So the Supreme Court has two cases, a federal case and a California case involving this issue, which has been troubling the courts.
So how do you think they're going to come out?
I don't know. I think that there's got to be some – I mean, the problem is there's so many different devices. There's so many in-between devices. I mean, it could be a pager. It could be something that has just a little bit of information. It could be a laptop. You know, it could have a huge amount. Do you have kind of a floating rule that depends on how much information, or if it's electronic as opposed to mechanical like a wallet? Mm-hmm. Is that the distinction?
What about the fact that a wallet doesn't usually contain messages from third parties, but a cell phone does? I mean, if I send you a message, do I have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that message that exists even if you get arrested?
Well, how about a letter? You get a letter in the mail. Do you have an expectation of privacy?
People don't walk around with carrying 1,000 letters.
No, but they might have one or two.
That's a big difference.
The problem is the Supreme Court is always faced with this problem. Do you have a bright line rule that says if it's electronic, you have to get a warrant. If it's not, you don't. Mm-hmm. Or do you say it depends on the facts?
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, if it depends on the facts, which in a way is more rational. Is it a little phone? Did you just buy it and it's got very little on it or something like that? The problem that throws it back to the lower courts to try these cases over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And it leaves the police in a difficult situation because how do they decide whether to go to a magistrate? They look at the quantity on the phone, and the beauty of a bright line rule that tells them, you can always do it in this situation, never in this situation, is, you know, these guys are on the beat and they're trying to do things right, but they want to get it right. So a bright line rule is helpful. So that's the...
So the bright line rule that you would see would be helpful would be what, Myron?
I'm not necessarily advocating this. The court could say, whenever it's an electronic device, go to a magistrate.
Yes.
If it's not electronic, you don't have to.
Couldn't they compromise and say that any time there's belief that the phone contains evidence regarding the arrested offense itself, they could search it for that limited purpose at that time? And any further search would have to be conducted by a warrant once it's removed from the person?
How do you do it, though? I mean, you know, I'm not that sophisticated with technological devices, but how do you search a cell phone for only one thing?
Yeah.
Do you close your eyes when you see something else?
There's no way
you can do
that.
Let me play devil's advocate. Why wouldn't you have to get a warrant? I mean, the cops have got the cell phone.
They've got possession.
They've got it. So they get a warrant. What's the big deal?
Yeah. Well, you could say that about a wallet, but the court does not require it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't require it for these other things. So what's the difference? The other situation that came up recently involves GPS. In Washington, D.C., the police get some information. This nightclub owner, Jones, is dealing drugs. They take a GPS finder that communicates to the police. They put it on the bottom of his car.
Right. They attach it
to this Jeep Cherokee.
Yeah.
All right. And all it does is signal to the police where this guy is.
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
They left it on there for a long time, 20 days or something, and, you know, detailed all his movements. Now, prior cases dealing with this type of situation said that this was perfectly all right, because the information it was communicating was available to anybody anyway. You could see this guy driving on the street.
So, in other words, what they're saying is they could have had an investigator following
this
guy.
Exactly.
As opposed to a GPS device underneath the car. They could have had an investigator following.
And when you go out on the street, Chuck, and drive down the street, and the police or anybody sees you, that is not a search, as that word is used in the Fourth Amendment.
No.
So they don't need any justification, any warrant. And the argument was, that's all this transponder does, is communicate where the guy is. Surprisingly, the Supreme Court held for the first time that the placement of the responder on the car was a search.
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
It was a trespass on the car.
Sure.
Well, sure, it was technically, but up until now, the test as to whether it was a search was there an intrusion on a justifiable expectation of privacy? Now, you don't have any privacy on the bottom of your car. That's where the grease pan is, right? There's no privacy.
I guess there's not.
You don't keep papers there or love letters or anything like that.
Well, maybe some of us do, though, Byron.
Well,
okay,
San Francisco, you never know. You're right about that.
I think the case you're going to be hearing a lot about over the next couple of years is a 1979 case called Smith versus Maryland, which is a case that upheld the use of a pen register.
What's that?
A pen register is a device that records phone calls. Not the substance, but who gets called, the phone numbers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the issue that the Supreme Court is going to face, which is really a similar issue to the cell phone case, is does the NSA's collection of metadata, you know, a pen registry writ large, or is it something different? Two federal judges have already decided that issue different ways.
One is that it's unconstitutional, the other that it's not constitutional.
That's correct, yeah.
Or one that it is, pardon me, is constitutional.
Right.
See, the problem is it's a new world.
But, oh, yes.
But a brave new world.
Yeah. The way judges operate is they're always applying old principles to new situations. But this is so new. It's so different. What are they going to do?
But, Myron, on the GPS device, you were getting to the point that the court had made a decision with respect to placing this underneath this
That's
car.
Right.
What was this? This was the U.S. Supreme Court.
United States Supreme Court.
What did they say?
They said that a trespass on objects is a search, whether or not it intrudes on privacy.
What was the lineup on that decision? Do you recall?
Scalia wrote the opinion.
Oh, okay.
Scalia's writing most of these opinions.
I mean, okay.
People think of him as very conservative, which he is, but he's a very strong libertarian, and he's really protective of people's rights vis-a-vis government intrusions. He's the one that wrote that decision a couple of years ago on the use of thermal imagers.
You're going through the airport terminal.
Well, no. This was somebody's house. There was suspicion they were growing marijuana.
Oh, sure.
The police go outside the house.
Yes.
And they have this machine that detects heat coming off the house, extra heat.
Yes.
Of course, you use a lot of heat in growing marijuana. And Scalia says that's a search. Even though you're outside the house, you don't go inside the house. The machine doesn't go into the house, but it detects heat coming off, and it could be the lady of the house taking a shower.
Weren't the officers on the actual property?
No, they were not.
They were on public property.
On public property, yeah.
That's very interesting.
Now, this leads into the case Ira was going to talk about with dogs.
Yeah, let's talk. We've got a few more minutes of the statewide version, Ira. What's this about the dog?
Well, the Jardines case, the U.S. Supreme Court held that even though a police officer has a right to walk up to your door, knock on your door, you have a right to answer it or not, when they walk up to your house with a narcotic-sniffing dog, that's a search. And they had an expectation of privacy in that house, apparently very similar to what you were just talking about, Myron. Even though the police officer had the right to be there, he didn't have the right to do the actions he did, that is, bring the dog to determine whether or not there were narcotics in that house.
Even though, and if you would do this for us, obviously the certified narcotics dogs, when they alert, they have been trained to respond to the smell of some type of narcotic. In this decision you're talking about, Jardines, was this a situation where the narcotics, the canine dog, had alerted while the officer was right there at the front door, or did they even discuss that? Do you recall?
If I recall, the dog did alert, and they went to get a warrant after that.
But the search occurred before the dog alerted. It was the act of bringing the dog up
just
there.
Just up to the front door.
That was the search.
Yeah.
And if you don't have probable cause and a warrant to do that, it's illegal.
So Alito, no, who wrote the opinion on that one?
Well, these all seem to go the same way.
Was it Scalia on this one?
Isn't it always Scalia, Roberts, or Alito, Thomas?
Yeah,
and
I think so.
With Kennedy joining them?
I forget, but the, mm-hmm. the important part of the opinion, and I haven't read in a while, maybe Ira knows more, was that they felt, as Ira said, even though a cop coming up to your door is not terribly intrusive because you got a front door and a porch there for people to come up and
sure.
knock on the door and talk to you, the dog made all the difference because it's more intrusive. How did they say it was more intrusive? Do you remember?
I have the decision in front of me.
Ira is now going to read to you the entire decision.
During the break.
There was
during
no
the break,
customary yeah. invitation to do that. Mm. They only learn what they learn by physically intruding on defendant's property to gather evidence, and that's enough to establish a search.
And who's the author of this opinion? You got it?
I've got it in front of me, and it's Justice Scalia.
Justice Scalia. Uh-huh.
Joined by
so there we are.
Yeah. Okay. Thomas Sotomayor.
Sotomayor was there on that one also. Okay. All right.
The liberal
who
one.
Who else? Who else was on there?
Thomas Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and I lost my page.
Elena Kagan?
Yes.
And Elena Kagan. All right. Very, very interesting. All right. We are coming to the end of our statewide version of the program. We are going to continue for another half hour. And those of you who are actually listening to us live will have a chance to call in both on the air as well as to our lawyers for Call a Lawyer. I can see one of the lawyers still on the phone. For Call a Lawyer, this is our regular Call a Lawyer night. And by the way, it is 728 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. The topic is recent U.S. Supreme Court cases. I'll tell you who our guests are in just a minute, but I want to let you know who our attorneys are for Call a Lawyer. This is a great public service that these attorneys perform. Many of them have been doing it, believe it or not, for several years in conjunction with this program. They are believers in trying to inform you and be available to talk with you briefly on the 800 number, which is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. And here's who we have. For workers' compensation law, certified specialist Alice O'Sullivan, former chair of the Board of Legal Specialization. Certified specialist Jeff Hayden for criminal law. Certified specialist Janet Lee Frankel for family law. George Cermatis, who is here for Social Security law, in case you have Social Security law questions. For immigration law, because we did a program last week on immigration law, and we had a very significant response. Gene Sverdlov is here for immigration law. For landlord-tenant law, Joseph LaPera. Employment law, Arlo Uriarte. Tax law, real estate, Frank Adam. Patent law, aviation, Lemon Law, Ron Rohde. And tomorrow, if you're being hounded by creditors and you're looking for relief, Leon Baer, who's a certified specialist in bankruptcy law, will be available to speak with you on his 800 number between 8 a.m. and noon, and that is 1-800-477-3111. 1-800-477-3111. If you call and get Leon's voicemail tomorrow morning, leave your name and phone number, and he will call you back. Again, this is all volunteer services by these attorneys, no obligation on your part whatsoever. And again, if you'd like to speak to my guests on the air, 1-415-841-4134. And my guests are Myron Moskovitz, constitutional law professor at Golden Gate University School of Law. Ira Howard Barg, specialist in criminal law. He's an assistant district attorney, San Francisco District Attorney's Office. And Steve Mayer, a specialist in appellate law. Our specialists are certified by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. And let's start with Karen. Karen, thank you for being patient and waiting. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening. Great show. I'd like to address this to Myron Moskovitz, constitutional law professor. So last year when President Obama was inaugurated, he was out in front of the public. He put his right hand on the Lincoln Bible, and he swore to uphold, defend, and protect the Constitution of the United States of America. So his secret, and I might add illegal, domestic spying and surveillance program is in violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America. And by him violating that law, that is an act of treason. Therefore, that is a criminal act. And in the old days, you would be taken out and hung. So what's Myron's opinion on the fact that the president is violating the Constitution that he has sworn to God and to the American public to uphold, protect, and defend?
Karen, thank you for your call. I don't know where Myron's going to go with this, but turn your radio back up if you would.
I'm trying to think of a president who didn't have some law he sponsored struck down by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional. I mean, by that rationale, Franklin Roosevelt should have been hung about 10 times over. Mm-hmm. Lincoln, you can't name one that hasn't lost at some point. They take an oath. They do the best they can. And sometimes they win, sometimes they lose, like the rest of us. But, I'm sure Obama had lawyers that advised him that this probably was legal. And... you take your chances. I don't think a president is a traitor when he misses.
The Supreme Court has not ruled on this thing.
As far as I know, that's correct. Yeah.
Pardon me. Go ahead, Steve.
No, that's right.
Yeah, the Supreme Court has not ruled on this.
And there are two conflicting district court decisions, as we mentioned earlier. One upholding the NSA metadata program, and one invalidating it.
Mm-hmm.
So the lower courts are split. And it's going to take a while for the issue to percolate through the courts.
Do you think it will reach the U.S. Supreme Court?
It certainly will if a court of appeals invalidates the program.
Okay. All right. Let's, Karen. I don't know that that's the answer you wanted, but that's the answer you got. Okay. Thank you very much for calling, Steve. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Great program. Hey, has anyone on the panel been to the Supreme Court and actually watch the case? Because I have.
Yes.
When I was out there, and I would recommend that to anyone who takes a trip to D.C. if there's an oral argument, and it doesn't matter if it's a pretty small case or what, but to go and to watch it was fascinating. And that's why I enjoy it now when on the TV, on C-SPAN, they're putting a lot of these oral arguments. So would you guys comment about kind of the breakdown of the, if it's a criminal, it seems like half of them are kind of very small business type of technical cases, and then the other half are things that actually affect people, whether it's the patent type cases or this case that's going to come up about the TVs with the internet or things of that type.
So what are you asking them to do, Steve,
so
briefly?
So kind of what the breakdown of the amendments. I mean, we had our first one of a gun case was last year. And also, what's a good resource for people that are interested? I think SCOTUS blog is a fantastic thing on the internet.
Let me get some
thank
response
you.
For you, Steve.
Yeah, well,
thank you very much for calling.
You have to understand that the Supreme Court sees its most important role as resolving conflicts among the federal and, to some extent, state appellate courts around the country. There's only 9 justices, and we have a very large, complex country with thousands of important issues coming up, and we have very competent judges throughout the country in various appellate courts, and the Supreme Court says, let them do their job. It's only when there's a conflict among them, so the law is unclear, that they tend to step in and resolve the conflict. So it's not that they're out looking for these hot-button issues particularly, but they have to resolve those conflicts. So what might strike you as an unimportant area or something small may not be small or unimportant to that particular industry or those particular people. We have these landmark cases everybody cares about, gay marriage, segregation, that type of thing. But these other cases are important too. I wouldn't necessarily diminish them just because they don't hit the front page.
And I like to say not everyone can go to the Washington to watch the U.S. Supreme Court, but anyone in San Francisco can go down to McAllister Street, watch the California Supreme Court, watch oral arguments of the courts of appeal.
It's a lot easier to get a seat, too.
It is, and I've done that, and it's actually fun watching some of these cases being argued by excellent appellate attorneys.
Yeah, I would say two things. One is that there are a lot of cases, quote, low visibility cases that involve business that are actually very important to citizens as well as businesses. Two that come to mind are the cases upholding mandatory arbitration in a variety of contexts, even if that effectively leaves consumers remedy-less, for example, as the Supreme Court did in last year's Italian Colors case.
What was that?
That was a case where the court held that an arbitration agreement could preclude class-wide arbitration, even if that left the individual claimant with a claim that was too small to effectively pursue it through the arbitral process. Another example of the kind of cases that affect both businesses and individuals are the federal preemption cases, which, although technical, have to do with whether people can assert rights under state law, generally tort claims, in the face of claims by businesses that the claims are preempted and thus invalid under federal law. Those, again, are cases that affect a lot of people. They're low visibility, but they're important. The other thing I would say is that going to the U.S. Supreme Court is a really terrific experience. I've been involved in a couple cases there, and it's just amazing to be there. If you're involved in a case, you're really about 15 feet away from the justices, and even the spectators get a terrific view. Mm. It's great theater. It's majestic. It's fun to watch. And even if you go on a day when they're not hearing same-sex marriage or something earth-shattering, it's all just watching the back and forth is very, very interesting.
Steve was talking, though, that many of the arguments now, if I understood him correctly, many of the arguments now are on some some website or some channel where you can actually see.
Court TV, you mentioned.
It's Court TV.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court arguments are not televised, but they're on SCOTUS blog.
What does that mean? What's SCOTUS blog?
It's a blog that a bunch of Washington lawyers have created that is really the go-to site for anything having to do with the Supreme Court. It's scotusblog.com, I suspect. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that may be
it's
the,
easy to find.
But you can also go to the U.S. Supreme Court
and
website.
The Supreme Court's own website has oral, A-U-R-A-L, recordings of the
These
oral
are recordings that you
yes.
can
and
you
and they're
can
usually
view.
The
okay.
same day.
All right. Oh, really? The same
yes.
day? Okay. All right. Let me give you our phone number again in case you have a question, comment, some discussion you would like to share with my guests on the air. 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. And also, give our Call a Lawyer lawyers a call, if you would. It's 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. They are here to talk with you off the air if you have a question in areas of workers' compensation, criminal law, family law, social security law, immigration law, landlord-tenant law, employment law, tax law, real estate, patent law, aviation, lemon law, and bankruptcy law. And that'll be Leon Bayer tomorrow, Thursday, January 30th, from 8 a.m. to noon. His 800 number is 1-800-477-3111. 1-800-477-3111. He is in Los Angeles. And again, any call you make for Call a Lawyer, whether it's this evening or tomorrow with Leon Bayer, no obligation on your part whatsoever. So don't worry about that. I'm Chuck Finney. This is Your Legal Rights. My guests are Myron Moskovitz, constitutional law professor, Golden Gate University School of Law, Ira Howard Barg, specialist in criminal law and assistant district attorney, San Francisco District Attorney's Office, and Steve Mayer, specialist in appellate law. And let's see, we've got Tim. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Tim, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. So I had a family law question. Are you saying I'm
going to... No, I think what you want for family law is you want to call the 800 number. Let me give it to you. 1-800-525-9917.
Right.
Call that number, 1-800-525-9917.
I got it. Thanks
yeah.
so much.
Okay, thank you very much. For those of you, however, who would like to talk to my guests on the air about constitutional law issues, it's 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. And I'm sorry that someone got confused about the numbers. Sometimes telephone numbers do get us confused, which is which. And so in any event, I hope that we can get this straightened out. You know, you mentioned, Ira, the Florida v. Harris case, which is another Supreme Court case involving a canine sniff dog, certified canine sniff dog. Very briefly, before you take our next call, what's that case about?
Well, that was the case where the Florida Supreme Court held that in order to use the results and establish probable cause through a dog, you have to go through the hoops. You have to prove and give a lot of information regarding how often the dog was right, how often the dog was wrong, the training and everything else. The U.S. Supreme Court said that's not necessary. You do, in the proper case, have to establish that the dog is reliable. Mm-hmm. You can do that in different ways. There's no one set of rules to do it, but they did find that it's evidence that can be considered in establishing probable cause for the search or an arrest of an individual. I don't think it's much different than any other method of probable cause. It's an individualized determination based upon the facts of the case, based upon the dog's history. The funny part is, in our office, well, California has a law that requires us to provide indiscretion, shall we say, of police officers to mm-hmm. the defense.
To the defense, sure.
At the same time, it appears we would have to do the same thing if we're presenting dog evidence regarding the dog.
Yes.
I have to do a whole workup to see how many times the dog has been wrong,
yes.
how many times the dog has not followed through properly, false positives and things like that. It's just another factor that somehow I'm actually kind of surprised it made it up to the Supreme Court.
Okay. All right. Let's get some, Martin, let's get some people up here so that we can talk with people on the air, if you would. We've got all these calls coming in, and I want to make sure that we get at least another two or three calls on the air. Again, for Call a Lawyer, I can see one of the attorneys who is not on the phone. Again, that's 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917 if you have questions in the other areas off the air. And we've got Kim. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I'm calling to find out if it's possible, theoretically possible, that in San Francisco we can have some legislation that would override the municipal transportation's ability to change routes and cut back services and that kind of stuff. Is there a way to oversee them? I'm just, as a frustrated commuter that tries to use Muni, they continuously cut services, and I was wondering if there was, like, a legal way to stop them from doing that. Thank you very much.
And when you say they, who are you referring to? Who do you think you're referring to by they?
I'm referring to the administration of the municipal
okay.
San Francisco Muni.
All right, let me see if...
The people that make the decision.
How has this, Kim, how has this, without going into a great detail, how has this inconvenienced you? What essentially has happened?
As such things as they cut a bus route and... you have to take two buses.
I see.
One bus.
All right. Let me see if I can get some comments to see if my guests do have any comments.
Well, I heard that you had that city attorney, the district attorney there.
Well, he's here, yeah.
I thought of that question.
But that is not the field that he is involved with. But let's see if I can get something for you.
He's not a bus lawyer.
Turn your radio back on, Kemp.
Yeah, why don't you take that one, Myron?
The structure of... government and law are intertwined, so you got kind of a hierarchy where the municipal railway, as I understand it, is run by the city of San Francisco. I don't think it's a separate entity. So the people in charge of that are the mayor and the board of supervisors, and they have the power to legislate to make things happen on the board, the Muni board, and. I think they also are in charge of the appointments, so that would be the next place to go. If you're not happy with
when
that...
When you say the next place to go, are you saying that she should file a complaint with the mayor's office and or the board of supervisors,
well,
or what?
I'm not capable or knowledgeable enough to give political advice as to how things, how to make things happen. I mean, it's look, yeah, find some member of the Board of Supervisors who's sympathetic to what she's saying. Talk to that person about how to get it done within the politics of San Francisco. You know, if she wants to go over their heads to the state legislature, which has more power, if she has the means to do that, she could do that.
Any other comments for her? Well, good luck to you, Kim. Sorry you're having a problem. Llewellyn, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I wanted to congratulate Professor Myron Moskowitz, who was my law professor in 1983 and after at Golden Gate Law School. He was the greatest of professors, and he not only made things lively and interesting, he also would invite us to play cards at friends' homes and stuff.
Was that for money, Llewellyn?
When you should have been studying, I assume. Well, I hope you're a very successful lawyer now, Llewellyn.
Something about how great he was as a professor, because there was no, I didn't see anything or hear anything about his retirement or becoming emeritus or whatever. But a quick question. Oh, I would also be curious whether he's still working as a school board member or on local Berkeley cases like the flea market case.
No, I am working on cases, but the era of Berkeley school board and Berkeley politics, I'm very happy that's behind me.
Llewellyn, what's your question, though, that you want to pose to them?
Quickly, I wanted to find out if he knew of the Edward Lawson case that the Supreme Court overturned the vagrancy statute that had plagued the country for generations. That was a gentleman, Afro-American gentleman, who liked to walk in pleasant neighborhoods late at night, and he was detained. He represented himself right up to the Supreme Court and won that. And these new laws, the sit and lie laws on sidewalks in San Francisco, seem to me to be sort of the replacement for these vagrancy statutes. What does Professor Moskowitz and your other attorneys there think of what's going to become of those laws?
So Llewellyn, you are a practicing lawyer now?
Oh, no, I didn't even graduate from Golden Gate. Hmm. I went there to learn the law and learned that I didn't want to practice the law.
Ah, and the Edward Lawson case, this was a case that actually was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, Colander versus Lawson.
Okay. Let me get some comments for you, Llewellyn. Thank you very much for calling.
Go ahead,
I'll
Steve.
I'll take my answer off the air.
I don't know the answer. I mean, I'm familiar with the Colander versus Lawson case, but I don't know enough about sit and lie laws to have an informed opinion.
Well, there have been a lot of cases about cities dealing with people sleeping in parks, lying on sidewalks, speaking out. They're very difficult cases. They're cropping up more and more as we have more and more of a homeless problem. And some courts have struck them down. There's one in Southern California who's recently struck down in some city down there that prohibited any type of sleeping in a public park. The sidewalk's a little different, I think, where, you know, people are trying to travel. If you can show that this is somehow directed against speech, then you get some First Amendment issues. But I don't know what the answer is. These are very, very difficult problems facing judges around the country now.
Yeah, I would say they're not free speech cases. I mean, the courts have pretty much, as I understand it, uniformly rejected the idea that sleeping is a form of expression. For obvious reasons.
All right. Any other comments on that? All right. All right. Again, our Call a Lawyer Night number is 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. And we have Dave. Welcome to the program.
Yes. In 1980, the movie, the motion picture, Raging Bull, was released. It was the story of Jake LaMotta, the boxer. The makers of the movie are being sued for copyright infringement. Could the gentleman comment on that case? It's now before the Supreme Court, and I'll take my answer.
Wait a minute, Dave. You are saying that this particular case is now before the United States Supreme Court?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's get some comments for you. Myron, you seem to be familiar with.
Well, I just what I read in the paper. I think LaMotta's is his daughter that's suing. I can't remember. She wrote a book or something, and she's claiming they took the movie off the book and didn't pay her. That's all.
How
I
would
know.
They? How
that's
would it get to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the federal Congress regulates copyrights, and
so,
these
so
cases
this
go
is
through
a copyright case.
Yeah, they go through the federal courts, and they can get to the Supreme Court. Yeah, I think it's in the Supreme Court, but I really don't know much about it.
Steve, you don't, and
nothing.
Ira, you don't. Okay, yeah. All right, Robert, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Robert, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was wondering what the panel thought of this proposal that was one of the, I think it's, this is a policy proposal that's been around for a while, so it's one of the more interesting ones that, to come out of the Perry presidential campaign to do away with lifelong appointments to the Supreme Court and have a sort of rotating court where, say, like every 18 years, you know, the Supreme Court justice would have to step down so that, such that during each presidential term, there would be two court appointments. And so sort of when voters would go to make their choice for president, they would already know that there would already be two Supreme Court.
Robert, are you saying that this is a proposal that actually has been formed at this point?
It's something that I read about during the last election cycle. And I, if I remember correctly, it was part of the Perry platform. But I was just curious what the panel thought of the...
Well, let's see.
The wisdom or the likelihood thereof.
So you're saying instead of... I think this is both for the federal court as well as the Supreme Court. If you are appointed by the president, you have a lifetime job.
Yeah.
Whether you're a federal district court judge,
all the way up,
court of appeals justice,
yeah.
or a member of the Supreme Court.
That's right.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Robert, turn your radio back up, will you? And we'll get some comments for you. What do you think about this idea that maybe the term should be only a maximum of 18 years, as Robert is talking about, or perhaps for each new president who's elected, that there would be it would be mandatory that the president be able to appoint two additional justices?
I think it's very intriguing, this Myron.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way it is now, it's so haphazard. Whether a president gets an appointment or more than one depends on the fortuity of whether members of the court retire. A president could serve one or two terms and get no appointments, or serve part of one term and get two or three. It
yes.
just depends on whether somebody drops dead in office or retires.
Yeah.
I remember I was a clerk for a judge on the California Supreme Court who was getting older and not in good health, and his political leanings were totally contrary to the governor at that time. And he said, by God, I'm going to outlive this guy. I don't want him replacing me with my political opposite. And, you know, I was sympathetic to that, but that's no way to no way to have a court, you know.
You would be in favor of some kind of
something like
limitation.
That. I think it's an intriguing idea because
okay.
you kind of want the court to you know, reflect the cross-section of the mm-hmm. electorate.
How about you, Steve?
I think I agree with Myron. Of course, this is a proposal that would only affect the Supreme Court and not the lower federal courts, who would continue to have life tenure. But the idea, despite its genesis in the Perry campaign, has attracted a fair amount of academic commentary, and by no means commentary that's on the conservative side of the spectrum, for just the reasons that Myron so well elucidates.
And the other
That's
problem
an intriguing
is
idea.
That there's a tendency now for presidents to try to pick very young people, like Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's in his 50s. You know,
yes.
I think when Oliver Wendell Holmes was appointed, he was, you know, he was up in his 80s, but he was so competent,
mm-hmm.
you know, you wanted to have him. Now, if you appoint somebody in their 50s, boy, and he's of your ilk politically, you're going to have him on there for 30 years.
At least.
And
yeah.
it also
yeah.
infects the nomination and confirmation process for the lower courts. One of the reasons why the Republicans were opposed to Goodwin Liu when he was nominated for the federal bench, and why the Democrats were opposed to Miguel Estrada when he was nominated for the federal bench, was the fact that they were so young that they were perceived as likely Supreme Court nominees had they been confirmed to the courts of appeals.
Mm-hmm.
So this rule, the life tenure principle, is now sort of seeping down in our hyper-politicized era into lower court nominations.
I'm not sure I want to just this. The Supreme Court is going to have to worry where his next job is coming from in the 16th year of his term.
That's a good point. Well, I don't think they're going to have any trouble, though.
But that's the reason for lifetime appointments. You want them immune from political pressures. But, I wouldn't worry about that. I mean, these guys are very employable after being a Supreme Court justice.
And maybe they don't even need to have jobs. Who knows?
Yeah.
Although they may want to be occupied that way. One further call, and very briefly, Greg, you have the last question, if you would, or comment, whatever it is.
Wow,
and,
boy, this is going to be tough. I was just calling in because I'm a disabled person living down the peninsula, been subjected to a fair amount of violations of civil rights as far as what I believe.
What county do you live in, Greg?
Santa Clara. Yeah, and I also housing discrimination. This is involved with the city and I live in a condominium complex, my homeowners association. And I'm just finding it hard to get anywhere in terms of trying to get an attorney, whether it's a law clinic like through Stanford or any of the advocacy groups that do work for disabled people. Even private attorneys, there doesn't seem to be anybody in Palo Alto that does civil rights. So I'm wondering if your guests have any suggestions about how I might go about redressing that.
And Greg, have you filed a complaint at all with the Santa Clara County DA's office on this?
Not about these issues.
Well, I think
unfortunately, the Santa Clara County's DA's office was unfortunately involved in what I would claim is a violation of my civil rights.
You're saying a conflict.
This is Myron. There's a disability rights group in Berkeley that provides lawyers in some of these situations. I can't remember the exact name.
DREDF.
Is what?
It's called DREDF, the Disability Rights and Educational Defense Fund.
Okay.
And then there's Disability Rights Advocates in Oakland.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
I'm sorry, Greg. Okay. We have come to the end of the program. Try the disability RETA program if you can, and see if that can help you. I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program. It's been a great pleasure having the three of you here. Myron Moskovitz, professor of constitutional law, Golden Gate University School of Law. Ira Howard Barg, specialist in criminal law. Assistant District Attorney, San Francisco District Attorney's Office, and Steve Mayer, Specialist in Appellate Law. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to have you here on the program. Next week, by the way, we are going to be talking about protections for homeowners and tenants in foreclosure or who have gone through foreclosure. My guest will be Leon Bayer, Certified Specialist in Bankruptcy Law, Keith Ogden of the Community Legal Services Office in East Palo Alto, Shirley Gibson of the San Mateo County Legal Aid Society, and Maeve Elise Brown, Executive Director, Housing and Economic Rights Advocates. Your Legal Rights production staff members, Program Engineer Joanne Marr and Production Assistant Martin McLean, funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Additional funding by the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Thank you very much for listening to this program, and join us next week. I'm Chuck Finney. Uh-huh.